the Skillful Means podcast, spiritual nourishment for yoga practitioners and teachers. I'm Sarah Jane Shangra.
And I'm Jennifer O'Sullivan. Join us every other week for conversations on integrating the Buddha Dharma, Taoism, and spiritual psychology with yoga.
Welcome, dear listeners, to episode 2, in which we will talk about the concept behind the title of our podcast, Skillful Means. So what are they, and why they are an important part of Buddhist practice, and what we yogis can take away from the teachings on skillful means.
But before we get there, Sarah Jane and I would like to take a moment to thank everyone who has been supporting us so far. Even though we're recording this episode before we've even launched a single one, we've already gotten quite a lot of feedback from people who've been writing in, telling us that they're excited, that we're putting something together, getting a lot of comments on our social media posts and people sharing them. So we just wanted to say that we see you and we thank you. It really helps get us excited about putting this out there, knowing that people are getting excited. So thank you.
Let's start by defining skillful means. Skillful means is a Buddhist term that describes the teachings, methods, techniques that support a practitioner's journey on the path to enlightenment. And of course, in Buddhism, the path is, well, the Eightfold Path, and generally studying the Dharma and following the precepts. And that can be for lay people or monastics. And of course, meditation is in there.
Yeah, meditation is a huge part of skillful means and definitely is the underpinning of all Buddhist teachings, really. And in yoga, if you're not as familiar with Buddhism, Patanjali talked about the 8 limbs of yoga, and each of these 8 limbs would be considered skillful means when practiced diligently and so forth. So you've got your yamas and the niyamas, pranayama, asana, pratyahara, dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Now we might give a little bit of weight to the yamas and the niyamas when we're talking about skillful means, because we're really talking about ethics.
Right. And you can also think of skillful means or upaya as enhancement methods for life, right? Using our natural intelligence for positive change. In other words, growth and development through skillful means, which includes letting go of unskillful means. Mm-hmm. So noticing and letting go of unwholesome behaviors and habits.
Yeah.
And just means that don't serve us any longer, that might be. And longevity practices, right? And you already mentioned asana, pranayama. This could also be what we eat. Mm. Anything that improves our health and well-being. They're skillful means, I would say.
Yeah, that makes me think of how the Taoists are really into prolonging life and how they embed moderation in pretty much all of the aspects of Taoist practice. I think that would be skillful means too.
Right.
We've also got practices that help us improve our own and others' lives and circumstances. So for me, these are the compassion practices, doing things that maybe align more with the bodhisattva path. A bodhisattva is an awakened being who has come back to earth or has stayed on the earth to help the rest of us. So I think of compassion practices as falling under this category of what skillful means are. One thing to keep in mind, though, is as part of the discourse on skillful means, the Buddha was pretty clear that people don't have to practice skillful means with a full understanding of their intention or even that that's where they're taking it. So in other words, you can derive benefit from teachings even if you aren't thinking about them in terms of achieving nirvana or enlightenment.
This point brings to mind how Buddhist-derived mindfulness practice is proliferating, in part because of scientific evidence purporting its benefits to our nervous system, relationships, productivity, etc. And so these days, masses of people are practicing methods for benefits other than those originally intended. And that seems to be really okay as far as the Buddha was concerned. In other words, they're not practicing because they're interested in attaining enlightenment or inner liberation or freedom. But, you know, they hear that mindfulness is going to help them be more productive at work or calmer or a better parent.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a really key point to underscore a little bit, that the Buddha himself said, it's okay if you don't have enlightenment as your goal. Skillful means are still helpful and beneficial. The other thing that kind of dovetails on this that he said was that the teachings don't have to be authentic or true, in quotes. We don't have to worry so much about whether we're doing things the right way. It's not that prescriptive. And I think over time, as you develop as a practitioner, you start to get a more nuanced feeling about whether or not something is skillful for yourself.
Absolutely. And the Buddha himself was known to change the way he taught depending on who he was teaching, right? So he taught different means, skillful means, to ascetics versus kings versus householders. So he, in essence, met his students where they were at. And as practitioners, that's something we can take on and do for ourselves. Where are we now and what do we need now?
This also makes me think of those of us who are teachers and the way that we approach the methods that we teach, and just being really careful that we aren't ourselves getting really attached, even if something was so beneficial and really helped us, whether it was a healing practice or some kind of aha moment that we want to share with everybody else. We need to soften this idea that what's right for me is right for everyone. You know what I mean?
Oh, I do know what you mean. I've seen that too. I've probably lived it. There's this clinging that can happen, particularly when something has worked so beautifully for ourselves, or we've seen it work so beautifully with a student. We kind of cling to it for a while, and it seems like the answer to a lot of suffering. Just do this. but it's not. And of course, there's a great parable, Buddhist parable about this. It's the raft parable, which is in the Lotus Sutra. And in this parable, the Buddha is explaining to students that this man is on a long journey and he has so far to go, and he comes up against a raging river and he can't cross it. There is no ferry, there's no bridge. And so what does he do? Well, this man uses the materials around him, branches, grasses, and he creates a raft that he can take across the river using his hands and feet as paddles. And he gets across the river. And then what does he do with the raft? The Buddha asks his students and he says, should the man take this raft, which was so immensely useful for him, and put it on his back and continue on? Or should the man set the raft down and move on without it because it had done what it was meant to do? And the answer is clear, obviously. It doesn't need to be said, but this raft seizing, right, is something that we all can do. Creating the raft in the first place is skillful. And seizing it and clinging to it and not letting it go, that's unskillful.
Right. Yeah, anything can outlive its usefulness. And I think it's really notable that the Buddha went on to say, and my teachings are this raft, so don't even cling to what I say. And this makes me, well, first of all, I'll just say I tend to, I don't know what it is, but for a long time I get I get my hackles up a little bit when somebody's really pushy with their method. I've always been a little bit like I want to push against that a little. And I think it's because there really isn't one way for everybody. And I think we just need to be really careful, especially those of us who teach, that we don't get so caught up in our method that we lose sight of the bigger picture, that we're dealing with humans, all their varied backgrounds and history, and everything is going to be a little bit different for everybody that comes along.
I love how much give there is, you know?
Yeah.
This is space in which we can be responsive, right?
Yeah.
And it's sort of the noticing of what may be useful for people. Well, first noticing what's going on for students, and then having a repertoire of skillful means that you can choose from, you know, so that you are offering teachings that really meet the student where they're at, as we already said. Mm-hmm. And this is a practice of, you know, kindness and compassion. It's being responsive. It's not being prescriptive, as you said before.
Yeah. It was something that jumped into my head as you were talking was that, you know, some people want the quick fix. And certainly as a teacher, it asks more of you when you have to grow a bigger toolbox of techniques that you can call on. And so I just wanted to hold a little space and acknowledge anybody who's listening that might be thinking those kinds of things, like, what do you mean? I just want the thing. Just give me the thing. Or I don't know so many techniques. I don't know how to meet different people where they're at. I would say to anybody like that, you know, especially if you're a practitioner, lean into this idea that some things take time and take diligence and work. The Buddha called that right intention. And also, as those of you who are teachers, you know, give yourself a break and, you know, just commit to a path of learning. I'm not saying go to 500 teacher trainings a year, but just keep an open mind that you're going to have to keep reading, you're going to have to keep studying and keep current.
You'll have to be a lifelong learner.
Yeah. Another story that comes out of the Lotus Sutra is the Burning House Parable. And this illustrates a slightly different point about skillful means. And so I'll tell the story first and then I'll unpack it a little bit. So the story goes that there is a father who is standing outside of his house watching it burn. And he realizes that his children are inside. So he calls to them, come out, come out. You know, you need to get out of there. And they're saying, no, we're playing, and they just won't leave. And as a parent, I totally understand that. And he decides that he's going to have to get a little extreme, and he can't run in and get them. So he screams to them, I've got all your favorite toys here, but if you want to play with them, you have to come out. And so they do. And so this is a curious story to slide into a conversation around skillful means because, in fact, the father is lying to the children to get them out and to save their lives. And the Buddha was basically saying that sometimes the end does justify the means, that there are always some nuances in what is and isn't skillful. And so we need to kind of sometimes think on our feet and also understand that some circumstances require some extraordinary measures. You know, if the father was just asking the kids to come outside and get some fresh air and then he lied to them, maybe that's less of a justification than, you know, saving their lives. So that's one aspect of skillful means that sometimes doesn't get talked about too much, but it definitely is a recognition that it's not a black and white, clear-cut answer.
No, there's gray. It's gray.
Lots of gray. So I think this is a good time to talk about how do we discern what is and isn't skillful mean, because it seems like the Buddha offers a tremendous amount of latitude, but it's also the case that skillful means aren't just anything either. So whatever you're doing has to further you along the spiritual path. And so you need to be, at the very least, trying to cultivate and develop some wholesome qualities. And at the same time, you need to be working on letting go of some undesirable conditioning. So it's really a two-pronged approach, cultivating the good, softening some of the things that aren't really serving us. Otherwise, it's kind of indulgent, and at worst, it's dishonest. Like if the father in the house parable had been lying for no reason.
Right. And the Buddha does offer, or let's say the Buddhist canon, does offer a lot of other guidelines.
Yeah.
As we mentioned before, there's the Eightfold Path, the precepts, the paramitas, and these all outline boundaries and, you know, parameters on how to progress along the path rather than regress.
And, you know, don't worry if you've never heard of all of these. Some of these things we're going to unpack in future episodes.
Yes, good point. So we want to be careful that we don't engage in mental gymnastics to justify means that just entrench us in our less skillful perspectives and habits.
This makes me think of the ways in which a lot of people in the self-development world, what Kelly Deals calls the women's, was it lifestyle empowerment brand? Is that what she says?
That's what she calls it, yes.
And there's all this lip service about people being true to themselves or living their truth. And it strikes me that sometimes this is used as a way to justify really super materialistic behaviors and lifestyle choices, or even going so far as to be closed-minded against other people who live different lifestyles. So, you know, I think we need to be careful that, like you said, that mental gymnastics of things seem like they're growth-oriented, but you're actually kind of justifying staying exactly where you are, not moving ahead.
Right. This reminds me of a favorite Amy Mann song that calls out justifying poor behavior with, well, this is the real me. Mm-hmm. You know, take it or leave it.
Yeah.
The song is, that's just what you are. And I'm thinking specifically about the lyrics. I won't fall for the oldest trick in the book. Don't sit there and think you're off the hook by saying there's no use changing because that's just what you are.
I like that. My 10-year-old says things like that, but she's 10. You know, I think at some point when we become adults, we need to own some of the things that are worth revisiting and looking at. Another point to make, I think, is to remember that enlightenment is not about being perfect. It's about being awake. And so we can soften this energy around looking at our own shadow parts and thinking that we only need to put our best selves forward, that we can't show any kind of darkness, or that we can't even acknowledge our own shortcomings, and that we can, you know, really just live in the world with our eyes wide open.
Yes, I once confessed my discomfort over a situation to someone I'll call a wisdom elder. And she simply replied, after I was, you know, just all caught up in this difficulty, she just replied, yep, that discomfort, otherwise known as being awake.
Yeah, I think Adyashanti says stuff like that all the time too, about his experiences being awake is not all rainbows and unicorns. So the overarching thread for discerning whether or not something is or isn't skillful means, I think it's put forward really beautifully by Zen priest Seth Sagal. And he wrote on his blog a really great quote that I'm going to share with you here, which is that the ethical life isn't a matter of following rules, but of committing to a particular line of inquiry, of asking which choices exemplify the skillful, the right, and the good in each moment.
I really like that idea of committing to a particular line of inquiry.
Yeah.
That's great.
It's like a little little question you could throw out there in any circumstance. Is this skillful? Is this going to make things a little bit better? Is this the right way to go?
It occurs to me that makes life so much more interesting. It's a creative path of inquiry and choice, you know, rather than following rules.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about it that way, but I think that is probably one of the reasons why I'm so attracted to Buddhism, because generally speaking, a lot of my parts don't like rules.
I'm with you. And we probably can't, you know, leave a conversation about skillful means without talking about the bodhisattva, right? Because upaya, skillful means, shows up as one of the paramitas in some Buddhist lineages. There are different versions of the paramitas. And again, that's something we will unpack in another episode. But they're basically virtues that one must embody in order to become a bodhisattva, which you mentioned earlier, Jen, is like an enlightened being who commits to the compassionate path, staying around to help others wake up. So in the context of the paramitas, skillful means are often equated with discernment or doing what is compassionately appropriate in any given situation.
Yeah.
Right. So, and compassion is such an important thread in Buddhism, that whether or not something is compassionate might be a concrete way of measuring whether it's skillful or not. So Jen, given that we are yoga teachers and certainly many of our listeners are yoga teachers.
Yeah.
Let's use this question around what is and isn't skillful means to evaluate trends in the yoga world.
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. So these days, there are a lot of deep conversations happening in the yoga world about what is and isn't yoga, whether or not lineage is important, especially in the light of fallen gurus. And we have market forces forcing teachers to come up with novel ways to fill their classes. So we end up with these trends. They're causing a lot of concern among some teachers and practitioners. And I'm talking about trends like yoga with goats, yoga paired with alcohol, and other things that bring together a spiritual and healthful practice with things that don't seem to align with that.
Yeah, so the common argument with these gimmicks is that it gets people in the door who wouldn't normally practice. And on the one hand, I get that. I get that we all benefit from yoga, and it's changed many of our lives. And I know I speak for many that there's a sense that if more of us were practicing yoga, the world would be a better place. But I do think we need to ask the question about how we recruit more practitioners and whether or not that's skillful. So, you know, part of me thinks that this is bait and switch. And, you know, luring people in with animals or beer and then offering up spiritual teachings, it doesn't feel good to me. And it really could be because when I was, I think I was like, must have been 15, because we had just moved house in the middle of the summer and I didn't know anybody. And so my parents finally agreed to send me to driving school as a way to potentially meet other kids my age, because, you know, we're all 15 trying to get our driver's license. And I did meet a nice girl. She wasn't normally the kind of person I would hang out with. She, you know, was a little bit more into fashion. I was a little bit dark and frowny and liked the gloomy music. And she was, you know, she had her nice bags, but she was my age and we seemed to get along. And I was fine with that. I went over to her house a couple times and things were great. And I knew she was a little bit religious. This was Texas after all. And so one day she asked me to go to a movie that her church was putting on, and there'd be pizza and it'd be really fun. And, you know, we'd bring our sleeping bags. I don't think we stayed there, but the intention was to kind of simulate a group spend the night pizza party or something. And we get there, and it turns out that she was a member of a very fundamentalist church, and the movie was on the rapture.
Uh-huh.
And all of these talks around that were about, you know, what are you going to do if you're not saved? And I mean, I'm from the South, so it wasn't like I'd never heard that stuff before, but it was, it just felt, I felt very betrayed that somebody lured me into this setting where I was being recruited. And I felt unsure about whether or not this person was even ever my friend or if she was just in on it, you know? And so I feel really strongly that luring people in to then share spiritual teachings with them is not the right way to go. I think it's really manipulative and dishonest, to be perfectly frank.
Mm-hmm. If not harmful.
Yeah, you know? Exactly.
So, okay, so in yoga studios, yes, goats are bait and switch if actual yoga is being taught.
Right. And but it's not being taught. No. So that's even worse. Maybe because, you know, I have this friend who went to a goat yoga class and she, oh, the goats are so cute. Oh, I love them. It was so fun. He was just calling on me and all this stuff. I'm like, okay, animals are nice. Yeah. But how was the yoga? And she said, oh, I didn't do any of the yoga. I was like, cool. So in this situation, they're not bait and switching because they're obviously not dumping heavy spiritual content on people when they think they're going to have a beer. But then if they're not even teaching yoga, then they're appropriating the word yoga.
Oh. Good point.
It's still not good.
Still not good. Yeah.
No. Okay. I'm sorry. So, I'm getting really worked up, but you can tell that I feel very passionate about this.
Well, we're going further then. So let me ask you, does with kittens and puppies help you to develop wholesome qualities or soften unskillful qualities?
I don't think so. No. I mean, I think that you can find very legitimate therapeutic environments for interacting with animals. You know, there's studies about blood pressure dropping when you walk into a room with cats and walking your dog. You know, people with dogs are healthier, all those kinds of things. But if you're using these, if you're using the word yoga to get people to do those things, even if it's beneficial, it feels dishonest, and especially dishonest to the cultures that shared yoga with us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point.
So I don't think it meets the criteria of skillful means because there is so much manipulation bound up in these activities. None of it seems honest.
Well, are you there to develop your mind?
No. It seems like they're playing or drinking. We're going to get to that in a minute, right?
Okay.
All right. So I think we've established, at least I think we've established, that goats and other animals paired with yoga is just that. It's a gimmick. It's not really helping that many people. And it's actually harming some people who feel very strongly that their culture is being cheapened. And as a longtime practitioner, not even from that culture, I feel that way too. It really disappoints me to see that stuff out there. But I know, Sarah Jane, you have a lot of thoughts about yoga paired with alcohol. Do you want to go into that?
Sure, sure. So, well, the Buddha cautioned about the use of intoxicants because they are inherently numbing.
Yeah.
Right? And Buddhism is a path of waking up
right.
to how things are. Not escaping. If you're engaged in the work of waking up, then numbing out is antithetical to that project. So, and one of the five Buddhist precepts is to abstain from intoxicants. Or I've heard in some Buddhist communities, more permissive communities, actually of which I'm one, describe that precept as responsible use of alcohol.
Yeah, I'm not straight edge either. I do occasionally have a glass of wine. So I'll just put that out there.
Yeah, as do I, for sure. So, you know, and it occurs to me, I'm thinking about how in Patanjali's yoga, there is a similar concept. There's the concept of tapas, right?
Oh, yeah.
Which is commonly thought of as self-discipline. And perhaps it encompasses the idea of being mindful of what you consume. Especially something that would set your practice back.
Right? Yep.
So if the argument is that people who wouldn't normally practice are getting exposure to the teachings, by going to classes and distilleries or brew pubs. Mm-hmm. I think we need to consider what it means to start a practice with alcohol being part of it. Is that skillful? So once that connection is made, where does it go? I mean, it's not a foregone conclusion for everyone, but it's potentially harmful to some practitioners. And I'm thinking of people who come to my class in a prison where I offer yoga and mindfulness, and many of them are in recovery. And in prison, staying sober is a key part of their overall rehabilitation. And I think about how it would be for these women to come up against that trend or those offerings, those classes upon release. So as a community, we're not helping them.
No. Now, there's definitely a lack of consideration for the multiplicity of beings and experiences that people carry and then just showing up in those environments.
Right. So this is definitely not skillful means. And I think people in yoga land have the right to be very concerned about that.
Yeah. And, you know, I'll just say that we're taking a bit of a hard stand on this. And you can agree or you can disagree. But I think at the end of the day, if you take away anything from this conversation, it's that especially those of us who teach or who support these kinds of things by attending them should really think more broadly about the greater impact on our communities and really listen to the people who are raising their hand and saying, this doesn't feel good to me. This doesn't feel like it's you're not being good stewards of my tradition. And, you know, it's really a call to think deeply about what you're putting out there. You know, for the most part, most of us in yoga land are earnestly and sincerely practicing yoga using skillful means. So these yoga gimmicks, they get a lot of press, but doubtful that they make up even a small dent in the overall practice of yoga.
Sure. Thank goodness.
So let's come back to how the Buddha talked about our practice journey, outliving specific teachings. And, you know, this begs the question, what else is there as we're setting down teachings that are no longer supporting us? Is the path then just a series of skillful means, or is there something else?
There is something else, right? And that something else is prajna. Prajna in both Pali and Sanskrit is translated as wisdom. Mm-hmm. And I've seen another definition as, I'm quoting here, the quality of being very acute, perceptive, and flexible. So whether we reach enlightenment or not, cultivating wisdom is definitely a very grounded and attainable aspiration in our practice. While skillful means, upaya, firmly establishes one on the path to wisdom, these methods tend to stop short. They are tactical. And the methods that cultivate prajna are observational in nature. They are things that encourage self-inquiry and help us to uncover the deeper truths of our own nature and the nature of our existence.
Right. And you're not going to get that by refining your understanding of anatomy or doing more sun salutations or even relaxation exercises. Those are all great, but they're going to keep you swimming in the same part of the pool.
Well put.
So what you really want to be focusing on at some point in your journey is meditation, because meditation is really the means for cultivating wisdom, specifically methods like Vipassana or insight meditation, which are all about growing our understanding of the nature of ourselves, how we show up in the world, and the reality of the world that's around us. This tends to involve, practically speaking, a lot less doing and a lot more watching or listening or receiving. So we're talking about accepting rather than promoting.
Yes, and this is definitely something that gets short shrift in yoga classes, which is unfortunate, especially for anyone who is practicing and teaching with the aim of making the world a better place.
And you know, it's worth mentioning, Sarah Jane, that the last four limbs of Patanjali's yoga, Pratyahara, Dharana, Dhyana, and Samadhi, are essentially the same thing as the last two steps of the Buddha's Eightfold Path,
right,
which are right mindfulness and right concentration. So even though we've been talking from the Buddhist vantage point, this is also something that Patanjali encouraged. It makes up half of the Ashtanga, the eight limbs. So the world isn't going to get any better if a lot of people are doing asana. So we need to start incorporating these other methods that really help us to wake up.
Right. And whether you are a practitioner or a teacher, think about letting go of such a strong emphasis on skillful means in favor of making some space in your practice or classes for wisdom methods. Once we all do that, then I think we'll start to see an amplification of the positive attributes that come with wisdom, namely compassion.
Mm.
And if the world needs any one thing right now, I think it's compassion.
Yeah, definitely.
So on that note, our intention with this podcast is to talk about the means to progress on the path and to elucidate what it's like to take on these practices.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of the themes that we'll be talking about this season and beyond include core Buddhist teachings that you can incorporate into your practice and teaching, even if you're not pursuing enlightenment.
Which is fine.
Exactly. And practices like yin yoga that can serve as a gateway to a regular and deeper meditation practice. Incorporating Taoist energetic practices, including qi cultivation, with asana for health and longevity, and psycho-spiritual inquiry, which actually lies in that space between skillful means and wisdom methods, as these methods are both skill-building and revelatory.
Hmm. I can't wait to unpack all these wonderful topics with our listeners. Hmm. Well, I think that's it for now. Sarah Jane and I would like to thank you for listening. And if you'd like to share your thoughts with us, you can send us an email at feedback@skillfulmeanspodcast.com, or you can find us on Instagram and Facebook at Skillful Means Podcast. Our next episode will arrive in your favorite podcast app in 2 weeks. So make sure to subscribe so you get it as soon as it's available. Until next time, may our minds turn towards those practices that engender inner freedom.